listening to The Coffee Hour. I'm Andy Bates.
I'm Sarah Golseth.
We are continuing a history series today. We're starting a history series.
We're starting one, and I'm so excited.
We love doing history series with Dr. McKenzie, so we are pretty excited about this. We're going to take a look at the emergence of the Puritan movement in England at the time of Queen Elizabeth. Thanks to Concordia University Wisconsin for supporting the Coffee Hour. You can find out more about Concordia University Wisconsin at cuw.edu.
Live uncommon.
So what are the origins of America's biggest Protestant denominations? To answer this question, we must revisit 16th century England. So today we begin a new history series with Dr. Cameron McKenzie on the Puritan movement. Dr. McKenzie serves as professor of historical theology at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Dr. McKenzie, welcome back to the Coffee Hour.
Thank you, Andy and Sarah. Glad to be back at the Coffee Hour.
We have enjoyed the history series that we've done with you in the past and always excited to venture into something new. And we're picking up where we left off before. Mm-hmm. Now we're taking a look at the Puritan movement. What's important for us to understand about England, Queen Elizabeth, and the church that led to the beginning of the Puritan movement?
Yeah, a number of things. Let me just preface this for your listeners by pointing to the fact that when we look at the history of religion in the United States, for most of our history, it was dominated by Protestant denominations of various sorts. You can think of everything from Pentecostals to Episcopalians, with Lutherans somewhere in between. So lots of different forms of Protestantism. But the big ones that out of which the leadership and economic classes emerged through much of our history have been the Protestant denominations, whose origins go back to English-speaking Christianity. I'm thinking like of the Methodists and the Presbyterians, the Congregationalists, the Baptists, the Episcopalians. All of these big American denominations have their roots on the other side of the Atlantic in the English experience of Christianity. And of those that I've mentioned, all of them, with the exception of the Methodists, have historical origins in the period of the Reformation and then the century immediately following the Reformation, that is the 17th century, in England. So if you want to understand the American context of Christianity in which we live, we should realize that much of the origins of today's denominational spectrum really goes back to England in this period. Now, we did the English Reformation previously on this program, but today we're going to pick it up basically where we left off with the establishment of a Protestant church in England under Queen Elizabeth, who ruled England from 1558 to 1603. Now, in a certain sense, England was just like all the other Protestant nations and territories. The Lutherans were established in Saxony and other parts of Germany by cooperation with the rulers. They made the decisions ultimately that made Lutheranism the state religion of places like Saxony or Hesse or many, many others. Similarly, the Reformed churches that were successful were established in cooperation with the rulers. So we get a Protestant Reformed church in Zurich in Switzerland, in Geneva, in the Dutch Netherlands, in parts of the empire, in Scotland. It's always in cooperation with the rulers. So the same thing is true in England. England becomes a Protestant country on account of Queen Elizabeth adopting the Protestant faith for her country when she came to the throne in 1558. Now, again, just like all these other countries, when a Reformation was implemented, it usually went through various stages. Something would happen, and then they'd make another change. Something else would happen. Then they'd adopt a confession of faith. They'd abolish the Mass. All kinds of things happen gradually. And so, too, here in England. Now, a Protestant Reformation had occurred in England under Elizabeth's brother, Edward, who had been king from 1547 to 1553, and then his half-sister Mary had ascended the throne from 1553 to 1558, and she junked all of the stuff that Edward had done to restore Catholicism. And now Elizabeth came back in 1558, and she picks up the Reformation in England where her brother had left it off. And that meant in the spring of 1559, Elizabeth's first parliament, and I'll talk a little bit later about how parliament fits into all of this, but for right now, just realize that the first two pieces of legislation of Elizabeth's reign dealt with the establishment of a Protestant church in England for all Englishmen. That was the idea. It's a state church for everybody. The first piece of legislation was the Act of Supremacy. And as the name itself suggests, this was a piece of legislation that declared that the monarch of England was the supreme governor of the church in England. And what did that mean? It did not make the monarch a clergyman, a bishop, or an archbishop, but it did leave the final say on all ecclesiastical questions up to the monarch. And that meant appointments of high officials or adoption of confessional statements or reforms of how the church worshiped, all would have their ultimate source of authority in the monarch. So she's the supreme, in Elizabeth's case, she's the supreme governor of the Church of England. The other piece of legislation was an act of uniformity, and that had to do with worship in the Church of England. And what Elizabeth did was to basically pass legislation that put into place a Book of Common Prayer, that's what they called it, Book of Common Prayer, which included all the worship services that a pastor would need for both regular Sunday morning and special things like visiting the sick, burials, or marriages in one book, and that became the official worship book for all of the churches of England. Now, the fact that the monarch is the governor of the church and the fact that the book is a Protestant book means that as of 1559, England is a Protestant state church. Now, if we look a little more closely at the book, it is Protestant in its doctrine. You don't have seven sacraments. You've just got the two sacraments. The orders of service are very compatible with Protestant, and I'm using the word Protestant, I probably should say Reformed, because that's basically what we're talking about. So, for example, if you look at the communion service, all the sacrifice of the Mass, all the petitions to the saints, all of that is out, and what's left is a sacrament of bread and wine in which the people are talks about spiritually eating this bread and wine by faith in their hearts with thanksgiving. And that's good Reformed doctrine, not Lutheran doctrine, where you eat and drink with your mouth rather than with your heart. So it's a Reformed Protestant book. It's a Reformed Protestant church. Finally, I'll mention that a few years later, in 1563, the leaders of the church under the Queen realized that if they're going to make it really a Protestant church in England, they had to define what the doctrine of the teaching would be. So they put together a confession of faith, again, taking something that was kind of left over from her brother's reign, updating it slightly, and reducing it from 42 to 39 articles. This was a confession by the church in 1563, and in 1571, Elizabeth introduced this into Parliament so it became the law of the land also, so that another part of the Protestant establishment state church, besides the governorship and the Book of Common Prayer, came to be a statement of faith known as the 39 Articles. And if anybody would read the 39 Articles in their context of the 16th century, they'd see that they're Protestant. It affirms Bible alone authority. It affirms justification by faith in Jesus Christ alone authority. It affirms the two sacraments, baptism and the Lord's Supper. Kind of right down the line on every question, you're getting Protestant, not Catholic. And then on those issues that separate Reform from Lutherans, especially the Lord's Supper, it is very clearly not Lutheran. One of the articles, Article 29, says this is about how unbelievers do not receive the body and blood of Jesus. They may eat the sacrament with their mouth, chew the bread, and drink the wine, but they do not partake of our Lord's body and blood. So again, what Elizabeth is establishing in England is a Protestant state church. So, one respect, England is not all that different from what was going on the continent, but instead is quite similar. So you might ask, where did then this Puritan movement come from? What was that all about? Well, there were people in England, in the Church of England, good members of that church, who just thought that, yeah, everything here is really pretty good, but we can do better.
And we can talk more about that just after our break. We got to take a quick break, but I want to hear more about the Puritans. We are talking with the Reverend Dr. Cameron McKenzie, Professor of Historical Theology at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. We have so much more to cover after this break. You're listening to The Coffee Hour. I'm Sarah Golseth.
I'm Andy Bates. At Concordia University, Wisconsin, we believe you were created for a reason, to use your God-given gifts to help others, to live a life of self-sacrifice in a me-first world, to live a life that's uncommon. Whether you're taking one of 50-plus online programs or learning with us in person on the shores of Lake Michigan, you'll be equipped to make an uncommon impact. Learn more at cuw.edu. Concordia University, Wisconsin. Live uncommon.
Welcome back to The Coffee Hour. I'm Sarah Golseth.
I'm Andy Bates.
We are talking with the Reverend Dr. Cameron McKenzie, Professor of Historical Theology at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, about the emergence of the Puritan movement in England at the time of Queen Elizabeth. And we've got a nice overview of the historical context of what was happening with the Church of England at that time in the mid to late 1500s. And Dr. McKenzie, you are going to jump into the Puritans and who they are. So let's go. Who are the Puritans and where do they fit in with everything that historical happening at this time?
Okay. I want to say one thing, first of all, about the term. It's a term that was given to them by their opponents. It's kind of like Lutheran. We were called Lutherans because of the opponents. The Puritans are called Puritan because of the opponents. But unlike Lutheran, which can be defined doctrinally by taking a look at the Lutheran confessions, the term Puritan is much less precise. It's a word that's simply used for those folks who made public in some way or other their concern about the imperfections of the state church that had been established at the beginning of Elizabeth's reign. And those considerations are various. But that's the thing you want to keep in mind, that these are folks who just think that we could do better in England than the establishment has done so far. Now, one of the places where very early we find some people expressing concern, because they think this is not as good as it could be, was actually that Book of Common Prayer that Elizabeth had established in 1559. In particular, what the Book of Common Prayer did not do was root out every last vestige of medieval Catholicism. So, for example, the clergy were told that they should dress for their services the same way that medieval Catholic priests dressed for services. So there was no change in what we call today the vestments. If you went to church in 1560, you were going to look at a priest who looked exactly like the priest looked in 1557. And this was one thing that concerned some of the Protestants. They weren't priests. They were ministers. Their job was to proclaim the gospel, not to sacrifice the mass. So why in the world are they dressing the same? People thought that this would be a change that Elizabeth and her church would make, But in point, they didn't make it. So in 1563, some of these good folks introduced church legislation to change the vestments to what was typical in Reformed churches on the continent, kind of black academic robes. So get rid of the medieval stuff and go to kind of Protestant simplicity, the way they were doing in Scotland and other places. This had a lot of support. And when it came up for a vote in this church assembly, it failed to pass by simply one vote. But one of the reasons why it didn't pass was the Queen had let it be known to the leaders in the church that she did not like the idea of underlings telling her how to run her church. And that meant telling her how the clergy in her church ought to dress. So from the Queen to the top authorities, this movement to change the vestments was stifled. But that didn't mean that some people out there in the church didn't start making the changes anyway. And so there was some attempt, and a couple of big shots at Oxford had to be basically fired because they would not go along with the old medieval vestments. They wanted simpler Protestant vestments, and they didn't get it. So that was one place where we find concerns fairly early in Elizabeth's reign, is about the Book of Common Prayer, about the vestments. And there were other things in the Book of Common Prayer that they didn't like. So, for example, sometimes the clergyman is called a minister, other times he's called a priest. We don't have priests in the Protestant church, they said, so we should get rid of that term priest. They also didn't like making the sign of the cross. That was superstitious. That's what medieval Catholics did to ward off evil. We don't have to have that. There was only one place in the Book of Common Prayer where they made the sign of the cross, and that was in baptism. That was the only place, but these folks said it shouldn't be in there anywhere. That's not from the Bible. It's medieval superstition. Let's get rid of it. Another one was the wedding ring. The wedding ring is not in the Bible. Again, medieval superstition. We should get rid of the wedding ring. And finally, one more was kneeling for communion. That's not in the Bible. We're not praying or worshiping the bread and the wine. We should be sitting. Well, that was in the book, and they didn't like that too. So there's a collection of things about the way people worshiped that these critics didn't like. And what they were operating with, we later came to call a regulative principle. And that was a rule that you would not do anything in worship that was not explicitly permitted in the Bible. It's kind of the opposite of what Lutherans do. Lutherans are big believers in Christian liberty. And that means your worship can include stuff that's not used in the Bible, but it's not prohibited in the Bible. So how pastors dress isn't a biblical regulation. So for us, it's fine. Well, I shouldn't say fine. You can dress kind of the way you want to in our churches, although I'm exaggerating a little bit. But the regulative principle said, no, this Old Testament, not New Testament, not approved in the New Testament. Let's get rid of it. So that was kind of the spirit of mind that we had for these Puritans right at the beginning. Now, Elizabeth's church had not changed the form of government. It was still regulated by bishops, archbishops, deans of cathedrals, etc., the old form of church government. And so the people who were enforcing Elizabeth's regulations regarding worship and the Book of Common Prayer were the bishops and the archbishops of their agents. And the fact that they were cracking down on what some godly people thought was the right way to reform the church led at least some of those folks to say, you know, this is another problem in the Church of England. We didn't reform the way we were governed. We should have replaced the bishops with a more biblical form of church government. And that more biblical form of church government, at least some of them said, was really more a Presbyterian system, where the church would be governed by the elders of the congregations. And that would mean, if you look at the Bible, that word elder does often mean pastors, but in some places it seems to me administrators or rulers of congregations. And so they thought, we need to replace the bishops with this other form, more biblically based form of church government, which today we call Presbyterian. And that's simply because the word, Greek word presbyteros, we translate as elder, and it is a word that does appear all over the New Testament describing the office of the ministry, especially. So other Puritans then, some, and I should, and this is where we get this a little confusing, just some of the folks who didn't like the Book of Common Prayer also did not like the form of church government. And so they began to advocate for it. Some even tried to implement it. And again, Elizabeth said, you know, you're not changing the way I have structured my church. So they actually went after them legally. Some of them actually were put into prison. Others lost their jobs. So there was a little bit of persecution. Now, here I should mention just quickly that even though the establishment did not accept the criticisms that these folks are making, there was a huge amount of loyalty to Elizabeth and the establishment in spite of that, because the big threat of Elizabeth's reign was always thought to be the Catholics. There were Catholic conspirators who were trying to assassinate Elizabeth to put on the throne instead Mary, Queen of Scots. And then there was Philip II of Spain, who launched the Spanish Armada against England to replace Elizabeth with a Catholic ruler. And those were big, big issues and crises, so that the vast majority of those who were Protestant really supported Elizabeth, and only a few of them ever went to the extreme of their criticism by saying, we've got to just leave this, we have to do our own thing. That didn't happen very much at all. But the origins of this movement are here during Elizabeth's reign. Now, got time, I'll do one more example of criticism.
Sure, we've got about 3 or 4 minutes left.
Okay, we can do this then. A third instance of criticism had to do with preaching. Reformed Protestants, like Lutherans, believe that a critical element of the ministry is proclamation of the word. That's what clergymen are supposed to do, proclaim the word of God. That meant preach it. But of course, when you have a church who's staffed by medieval priests, and simply on because of legislation like the Act of Supremacy or the Act of Uniformity, they have now become Protestant ministers, that does not make them able preachers. So what do you do? What do you do? Elizabeth's government did what happened in some other places on the continent, including Lutheran churches. They prepared sermons for these guys to read. Good Protestant sermons for them to read. And so only if you had a special license from your bishop were you allowed to preach. Otherwise, you were supposed to read. Okay, but at least some in Elizabeth's church said, well, you know, we ought to do better than that. We don't want guys just up there reading. We should train them to preach. And one way in which you could train them to preach would be to bring them together regularly in order to practice writing sermons and then preaching sermons under the auspices of church authorities in different places, maybe big churches, cathedrals, or something like that. That's what they had done in Zurich under Huldreich Zwingli. And the word that they gave to these preaching workshops, I guess that's what we would call them, preaching workshops, was prophesyings. But it had nothing to do with predicting the future. It had everything to do with preparing preachers. So some of the bishops who were good Protestants trying to make a Protestant country had set these things well, and that included Elizabeth's second Archbishop of Canterbury, a fellow by the name of Edmund Grindal. He thought this was a great idea. But Elizabeth did not think they were a great idea. She thought that when these guys got together, you know, and I think she had probably a point here, they'd start complaining about the establishment, maybe even complain about the queen, and maybe even start to organize a Presbyterian form of church government. So she said no to prophesying, and she said, Edmund Grindal, you're my archbishop. You've got to shut these things down. Grindal did something rather extraordinary. Almost without any subsequent example close to it, and that was he talked back to the queen. He wrote her a letter and basically said, this is none of your business. this is the business of the church. Preaching the word of God is the business of the church. And then he reminded her of how the Archbishop, the Bishop of Milan, Ambrose, had excommunicated the Roman Emperor Theodosius when Ambrose felt that Theodosius had done something wrong. So he actually kind of threatens Elizabeth. This was not a smart thing to do. Elizabeth was enraged, and what she wanted to do was basically fire him. But her advisors, who sometimes were better politicians than she was, said, no, why don't you just kind of put him on the shelf? And the word that they used for that was sequester. So Grindal, for the last few years of his reign as archbishop, was permitted to ordain and confirm, but he had nothing to do with the management and the running of the church. And that prophesying movement came to an end. And this kind of shows, again, the Puritans are going to live with this, but they're not going to like it. They're still going to believe that, you know, pastors ought to be preaching. And so they're still going to want these things. They're still going to want another form of church government. They're still going to want a purified form of their book of worship. In other words, they are still thinking about the Church of England that we could do better than we are right now. And so that's the emergence of this movement or this widespread criticism in the Church of England during the reign of Elizabeth.
And we will continue this history series with Dr. McKenzie next week, taking a look at the emergence of the Puritan movement. Dr. Cameron McKenzie, Professor of Historical Theology at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Thank you so much for being our guest today and helping us launch this new series.
I enjoyed it. Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to The Coffee Hour. I'm Andy Bates.
I'm Sarah Golseth.
The Coffee Hour with Andy and Sarah is a production of KFUO. To support The Coffee Hour and KFUO Radio, visit KFUO.org. You can also text KFUO to 41444 or send an email to gifts@KFUO.org. And you can call us at 800-844-0524. KFUO. Christ for you, anytime, anywhere.